Hello and welcome to the next segment of Buffalo Who Knew, a podcast which focuses on lesser known, often overlooked assets of the great city of Buffalo, particularly as it relates to the design, architecture, and natural environments of this wonderful city. I am super excited to be here today with my friends Greg Delaney and Beth Tokey, who are both professors at the University of Buffalo in architecture, and both of whom have taken considerable interest in this arena that we're going to talk about today, Buffalo's grain elevators. The incredible, I think I saw a quote of concrete Atlantises, yes, in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And just a little note, I was in Chicago 2 days ago, met someone in the architecture world there, and could not talk to me enough about these formidable structures. So welcome to the segment. So happy to be here with you.
We're excited to be here too.
So let's start off. Can you talk to me a little bit about the history of the grain elevators?
Well, how about if I do the elevator pitch and you can add the details?
Sounds good.
Okay, so Buffalo basically invented the modern grain elevator. And a lot of people don't know that, but I think it's really important for us to be thinking about it. That they then covered their waterfront with those grain elevators, which made a really fascinating fabric in this city.
Beth, what years would you...
About 1860 all the way through about 1930. Is that about right?
Well, the first DARTS elevator was 1842.
1842, okay.
So that's the kind
coinciding, right, with the Erie Canal.
Well, right, yeah.
So 1825 would be the start of the transshipment industry of grain in Buffalo, with the opening of the Erie Canal. And then 1842, the invention and the opening then of Joseph Dart and Robert Dunbar's original grain elevator. But then, you know, really then grew through the 19th.
So it really grew between 1860 and 1930. That was the big, the big kahuna in terms of when the elevators. Mm-hmm. And... there were about 48, right?
Yeah. It's hard to count grain elevators because a complex might have multiple grain elevators within that complex. So it depends on how you group them. Mm-hmm. But generally on the low end, I'd say we had at least 30 grain elevators. And really, if you count them, you know, you can count up to, you know, 40.
Up
some,
to about
to 50, 40.
Yeah, I've seen as high as 48. Yeah. So that's interesting. But then, of course, things happened. The St. Lawrence Seaway opened and... So
rail travel and cargo.
Rail travel changed. Train travel actually changed.
Yes.
So a lot of them were abandoned. And now we are slowly turning them into something that's more of a cultural entertainment housing kind of fabric.
Adaptive reuse.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Adaptive reuse.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So... that's it, and my understanding is that we have the largest collection of grain elevators still extant in the world at this point.
Again, it depends on how you count them, but I would say we definitely have one of the greatest collections of grain elevators in the world. And what makes Buffalo extra significant is, of course, that we are the city that invented the grain elevator. Mm-hmm. So regardless of how you count the numbers, it's the combination of quantity and that historic significance of the invention taking place here. Mm-hmm. That means the grain elevators that you see all over the world that look like the ones in Buffalo... you know, are all over the world because of Buffalo. So as that kind of moment of significance in 1842.
And the other thing that's really important in terms of Buffalo is the fact that there are so many of them that are together. So there's nowhere else where you have all these elevators in the same spot, which really has defined our city from my point of view. And I think that if one asks the question, what is unique about Buffalo? Really seriously, what is the one thing that Buffalo has that no one else has? It has this amazing collection of grain elevators on a winding waterfront. Who has that? No one.
It's quite dramatic. For those who haven't been to Buffalo, just imagine this winding river, the Buffalo River, with these cavernous concrete structures that create this visual landscape. It really is unparalleled.
It really is.
So given that you're both architecture, in the architecture field, let's talk a little bit about the evolution of the designs, mm-hmm. because, mm-hmm. you know, I did some background reading and they, you know, mm-hmm. so Greg, let's talk about that.
Yeah, sounds good. So as we mentioned, 1825 is the opening of the Erie Canal, which is really what forever changes Buffalo's trajectory. With that, Buffalo began building pretty immediately, small, mostly brick, 2-, 3-, 4-story warehouses. Because at that time, as grain came in off the lakes, it was individually bagged and priced and shipped stored in those small brick warehouses, coming in as they were unloaded off of larger lake vessels, temporarily stored before then all of that, those bags of grain were then moved into canal boats to go down the Erie Canal to Albany and ultimately New York City.
On the backs of Irishmen, I might
say. Exactly, yes. So mm-hmm. this was all immigrant labor, mm-hmm. You know, throwing these bags over their, you know, onto their back and moving all day, every day, moving grain up and down into these, from boats to these warehouses and back to canal boats. And so it was really backbreaking labor. Mm-hmm. So that's really the first typology of grain storage in the city of Buffalo were these warehouses. And you see some evidence of that. In fact, we've had some reconstructions, sort of loose reconstructions of that down at today's canal side. Mm-hmm. But then the next significant moment is 1842, when Joseph Dart, who was a local entrepreneur, who kind of an industrious guy in the hat and fur trade industry, was, as the story goes, sitting along the Buffalo River watching this process and realized that it was quite inefficient. There must be a better way. Mm-hmm. And so that's when he worked with an engineer, Robert Dunbar, and then created this steam-powered electrified process to then raise and lower grain. You would no longer actually, and one of the biggest innovations there was that you would no longer individually bag grain, but instead you could actually fill the hull of a ship with loose grain, you know, and then the grain elevator, which is actually a conveyor belt that extends down into the hull of the ship.
With a marine leg.
The marine leg, mm-hmm. Then pulls the grain up to the top of a massive storage building as an open silo. These were wooden buildings initially, mm-hmm. and then stores the grain in bulk. Before then being siphoned out and reloaded into canal boats. And so the bulk storage, the bulk shipment and the bulk storage of grain was a big innovation. And then, of course, that process of unloading and loading went from about a 7-day process to a single morning. Mm-hmm. So it revolutionized the movement of grain and thus the transshipment industry. And it made it much more affordable and profitable to ship and to store grain. And so there we see the annual receipts of grain handling in Buffalo just grow exponentially over the coming decades through the 19th and into the 20th century. There was a big problem, though, with the wooden buildings. There are actually several big problems. One, they were really conducive to rot.
Combustion. Yeah.
The biggest notable one is, of course, combustion. Yeah, so the average lifespan was cited to be about 12 years of those buildings before it was inevitable that they would blow up, explode, catch fire, especially because this was an electrified process. You know, sparks fly, and so by the kind of late 19th century, it was clear that another building, you know, that construction of these buildings had to change. And so then we saw a lot of experiments. There were experiments in tile bin construction, experiments in steel bin. And ultimately, it is concrete that became the new materiality, and especially a special technique called slip form construction, which was actually invented for the silo construction, invented in Minneapolis. And so the first experiment there was in Minneapolis in 1900. And so really the story of the modern grain elevator is this combination of Buffalo's 1842 invention and then the advent of slip form silo construction in Minneapolis that together make the modern grain elevator as we know it and as we see on the Buffalo River still today. And from that point forward, we see all grain elevators worldwide take the concrete form that we're familiar with. And so our oldest extant concrete grain elevator is 1906. That's the American. And previous grain elevators were generally all torn down to then rebuild in that form. That's why we don't have, we have one left. That's a tile bin construction from 1903, but
which
nothing
one is
at this
that?
Point. That's part of the former Washburn Crosby complex, which is now General Mills.
Got it.
But with the unfortunate loss of the Great Northern,
that was the real transition building because the Great Northern was still being construction and with a brick shell. And so this, and it was very successful as a kind of a method. And so this was probably, you know, that was why it was such a loss to see that building go down, because...
And for those who are not in Buffalo, this is particularly tragic because it was a recent loss.
It was recent.
It was locally landmarked.
Right.
And we won't get into too much of the politics around it because too many of us are way too sore. But suffice to say, it did not have to happen.
Not at all.
It did happen recently, and unfortunately it was the last of its kind, my understanding, in the world.
And possibly, exactly. And there was the oldest crane elevator left in Buffalo.
And it told such a beautiful story when we have all of the reinforced concrete slip form construction, and then we have the Great Northern and a few remnants of other things. We had a better story with the Great Northern as the kind of the linchpin.
And now we have a parking lot to look at. Mm. Yes. So, you know, progress, right? So, and then when I started to come back to Buffalo, the last remaining wooden elevator had burned.
The Wolberg, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course the H&O Oates was taken down.
Interestingly, I'm amazed that the Wolberg, it actually went down, because the way that was constructed, instead of having boards on end, it took very large, like 12-foot wide boards, stacked. So it was solid, and you would have to do a lot to really take that thing down. But it went.
It went. Mm-hmm. Well, so let's continue down this design perspective and the evolution of that, because that's, not only did we adopt a new form of material usage in concrete, but this had huge implications in the design world, well beyond the grain elevator world. So let's talk about that.
Absolutely. Well, these were feats of engineering, and in terms of architectural significance, I think that is something that a lot of people don't realize, is how important they became in the 20th century in the development of European modernism, which of course then was really exported or imported all over the world as an architectural movement. And so...
And that was Le Corbusier, wasn't it?
It was, and also people before him.
Gropius. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. So Walter Gropius was a notable moment because he, in 1911, gave a lecture that included slides of grain elevators, including ones in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. It was Corbusier who borrowed those slides then in the publication of some articles in his journal, L'Esprit Nouveau, and then ultimately published in his very seminal work, Towards a New Architecture, in which that also included a Buffalo elevator. And so the reason why the modernists were so taken with these buildings is because really they were these kind of just, I mean, on the one hand, just unbelievably powerful as forms, these kind of cathedrals of a modern age, a modern era, in terms of scale and power and presence. But they were created not by architects, but designed by engineers as pure expressions of their functions, right? And so you have these groupings of cylinders, of course, as an optimal form for the storage of grain. And when you group those cylinders together in these long rows, the way in which that kind of pure form is rendered and also enhanced by light, you know, forms assembled in light, as Corbusier said, and their monolithic qualities, you know, the fact that they aren't punched by windows, and so they're not storied in a conventional sense of a building, makes them almost these scaleless, monumental objects in the landscape.
And very pure in terms of their geometric form. And so, interestingly, they were machines first. Mm. They were not built for humans. So humans were, we might think about humans as part of the machinery of the great elevators. But when and you could say, okay, I'm going to build a machine and humans are going to be part of that machine. But they might not contain these beautiful platonic forms grouped together.
Mm.
But because they had these abstract, pure platonic forms as part of the way that they were built by utility, as Greg said, they became inspiration for the modernists, for sure.
Mm-hmm. How poetic. I mean, these huge industrial monoliths, but that were so form-based and simple and
And that's one of the beauties of them now, is that although we're not going in there with silos filled with grain, but when one goes in and you, these were not scaled to people. So when you go in and you start looking at the scales of these things, we don't have the opportunity to see that kind of space scaled in that way very often.
Except and now we're using them for poetry reading. Exactly. So we do.
Right. Now
so
we do.
But yes, we'll get to yes, that, that
right.
future.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
but yeah, so let's sort of bring it towards the tail end of this era of industrial might, which obviously fell out for Buffalo and many other cities in the Rust Belt. What was the next chapter? You know, what happened after the international recognition for design and innovation? And, you know, I'll put in a family plug that, that my family was in the business. And my family did, you know, my great-grandfather and my great-grandfather were, and my grandfather, excuse me, were in the industry and have one of the last remaining elevators that, that to my understanding, and I've been told, was a real, was really a vanguard in the innovation of the engineering.
It was. So
that's incredible.
It's my favorite building in Buffalo. And the reason, there are reasons for that.
Marine A we're talking about.
Marine A, right. Yeah. And the reason for, thank you.
1925.
1925, Charles Abel. And the reason, there are two, there are a number of things. It was a flow-through elevator. So it it was very adaptable. It took on, it was able to take grain from ships, move it into trains, and it was also one of the few elevators that had these the grain silos themselves go all the way to the work floor, to the subfloor.
To the ground, effectively.
Yeah, to the ground. Most of the elevators had, you know, that 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 subfloor, that work floor at the at the base, had hoppers that were and the silos themselves did not go all the way down. But Marine A did, and so therefore it has amazing qualities that the other elevators don't.
It's in that respect, it's even kind of purer
yes.
and simpler in its form. And so this kind of idea of the modernist fixation on the kind of purity of form is even ever more expressed in like Marine A because of that removal of the raised basement or that kind of ground level basement.
Exactly. And every time I go to the end of it where the head house is, where you go up to the top, there's a piece of it that looks very much like Le Corbusier's La Firme, and it's just, you know, it's amazing to see that and then see, you know, this
and
other piece.
Architecturally, you know, what happened is, so the modernists were, you know, totally fixated on these American industrial buildings, and so arguing, actually, that American engineers were really the best architects out of all architects in North America and in Europe and by extension the world. And so a lot of kind of damning statements by Corbusier and towards new architecture related to the status quo of architecture, architectural discourse and the products of architecture. And so what we see then thereafter is, of course, that inspiration coming from grain elevators and daylight factories, another major important building type in Buffalo.
Absolutely.
We see that line of inspiration really clearly in a lot of European buildings. And so then that, you know, kind of baton shifts to Europe where that inspiration drives an entire movement that then in turn comes back and inspires architecture in the United States and the world thereafter. Mm. But the grain elevators, they're, if you start looking at modern buildings, especially from the 1920s, you start to see the grain elevators in a lot of buildings. Mm. And really the most iconic, arguably, is the Villa Savoie by Le Corbusier.
Yeah, really.
And the only way I think to really understand that building in terms of some inspiration, and in addition to things like ships and automobiles, other chapters that he was writing in towards new architecture, is to actually think about the synthesis of the daylight factory, this rigid, gridded space, this kind of rational organization, with then the kind of sculptural qualities of the grain elevators, which is what begins to define the roof garden of that building. And so the curve, you know, the curving forms and these kind of pure white rendered surfaces of those sculptural forms. It's really the combination of these two building types in Buffalo and elsewhere that drives some of those icons of modernism in terms of their forms.
And let's plan plan to have you come back and we'll do a segment on Albert Kahn in Buffalo.
Yeah, oh, sounds good.
We're not talking more about his contributions in Buffalo. And so the bottom falls out. Many
St.
of these...
Lawrence Seaway opens up.
Yes. 1959.
There are new logistics in terms of rail transport, shipping transport. There are other competitions in terms of other ports. And so efficiency reigns and economy reigns, you know, the efficiency reigns. And so Buffalo loses out because there are better ways to go.
And it was a big fall because the 1930s was when we were at our peak in terms of grain handling and also flour production. In the 1930s, we became the largest flour producer, usurping Minneapolis before Buffalo, because you've got all this grain here. You begin using that grain, and so flour production goes through the roof. And it makes a lot of sense, too, because if you are a flour producer, you know, where would you locate to have the best pick of all the top quality grain? It'd be Buffalo, because that was
where all the
grain was flowing to. Mm-hmm. We were the bulk breaking point of the grain industry. But I think what's also, you know, this kind of collapse of the industry, it wasn't even just grain that was affected, because there were a lot of other things related to that. Mm-hmm. And so one, you know, actually the manufacturing of feeds is a big byproduct of grain. Mm. And so, in fact, 30% of every bushel of wheat milled is then going toward feed. And because Buffalo is positioned near the Eastern Division of the American Dairy Belt, you know, we're a big epicenter for actually feed distribution then, production and distribution. Also, anthracite coal moving from Pittsburgh and the, you know, Western Pennsylvania was all coming to Buffalo. And so all of this kind of on the backs of what appears to just be an industry about grain and the temporary storage of such, but then actually spawned all these kind of satellite industries in and around that landscape. And so we see a large collapse that is not just about grain, but about many industries tied to or fueled, previously fueled by that industry.
Essentially, this is the story of food and the transshipment of food. In general.
And in a period of this kind of emerging new global
expansion.
Yes.
This is where it was happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we're left with these relics. Mm-hmm. And yes, unfortunately, some burned or were taken down for progress, quote unquote. But we've got this repository that we're left with, which is just remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all agree we're not doing enough with it. Mm, I mean,
right.
I will put a comment in that several individuals, including Rick Smith and John Williams and others who did river works. There are there's now a new church that's inhabiting one of the elevators.
Yep. Yeah.
An architecture firm has turned one into its headquarters.
Yeah,
so there are adaptive reuse. Mm-hmm. There is happening, and in fact, at Silo City, one is now finally been converted into housing.
Right.
So that's pretty exciting to see.
It's the warehouse itself, not the grain elevator.
The mill
right
house.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but in addition to those stories of adaptive reuse in Buffalo, what we benefit by now is stories of adaptive reuse of grain elevators all over the world at this point, because you know, the success of places like Buffalo and Minneapolis meant these building types don't just exist here, they exist everywhere.
Right.
And so we can also point to major world cities that have also before us or alongside of us come up with interesting adaptive reuse concepts for these building types. And so we benefit from those stories too.
Let's talk about that. Yeah. Where do we go with these?
What do we do?
Let's hear your ideas.
We have ideas.
Yes.
Let's
wow
the listeners.
Yes. Well, Greg and I have been talking for a long time. We have very large goals.
Good.
Not small goals. One concept would be to develop a kind of a new but old kind of park using the grain elevators. And I would call it a dot-to-dot park, where one grain elevator is part of the park. There's a walkway or a way to get to the next one. Because we have so many that are in such close proximity to one another, one could actually make a dot-to-dot park
following
the river.
So a high line, but as a grain elevator featured
experience. Exactly. And the river line's, I'm you know, very supportive of what they're doing. That seems to be outside of what's going on with the grain elevators, but mm-hmm. it would be wonderful if the river line could then, you know, start to move into this.
Which is, for those not in Buffalo, is a project in the works right. to create a natural walkway in Buffalo's first ward in this area. But right. to your point, Beth, it doesn't currently include the grain elevators.
Not as a primary feature. But so if you think about, you know, let's say we celebrate Buffalo's best feature, which mm-hmm. are the grain elevators, mm-hmm. and we develop this dot-to-dot park, then we need to have a kind of a way to do that, which we both talked about, and we, you know, thought UNESCO might be the thing.
A World UNESCO site.
Because... Yes. This, you know, when you start to think about the fact that this is the story of transshipment, this is the story of food, there are so many firsts because
the story
of
labor, the story of engineering, right. the story of design, modern architecture.
Yeah. There are so many stories of firsts because of these grain elevators being here that it's very possible that we could become a UNESCO Heritage Site, mm-hmm. which would allow us then to make that dot-to-dot park.
And yeah. what does that provide? Does that provide funding? Does it?
Well,
yeah. So, I mean, it is a, you know, for those who might not know too, UNESCO World Heritage Site designation, it really is the preeminent designation worldwide, recognizing a global significance mm-hmm. that goes beyond what we often are talking about, which is local and national significance. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another piece of this is really... having people realize that we're not just talking about buildings that are important to us in Buffalo.
No.
Or buildings that are important to us in the U.S., but this site, this collection, and as a collective, that these are, you know, while we've got buildings by Louis Sullivan and Frank Lloyd Wright and Henry Hobson Richardson and a park system by Frederick Olmsted and all these amazing pieces of our architecture and landscape and urban collection here in Buffalo, I would argue that collectively, not any one individually, but as a collection, that the grain elevators are truly our most significant site and offering to the world in terms exactly. of historical significance and inspiration that was fueled by them. And so part of that is really just an acknowledgement that this is a site that rises to that level of significance. And it does unlock a lot of things. And what it does also... position is that, you know, that these grain elevators won't be torn down in the future, right? Buffalo kind of suffers from this symptom of, well, we've got a lot of these. So if one gets torn down, it's not that big a deal. That's we still right. got a lot, you know, but we're slowly losing them one by one. Mm-hmm. And I think...
and also allowing the ones that are here to decay. And yes, so there right. are not only the structures themselves, but... the embellishment, not the embellishments, the you give me the right architecture term, the stairwells, the bump outs, yes. you know, that are, you can see them rusting absolutely. And decaying.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, the marine towers, the, mm-hmm. you know, we're losing pieces of these all the time.
All the time. Mm-hmm.
And so this effort would now, you know, really create a preservation movement in the structures. Start to think of them as maybe a district.
Exactly. As,
yes.
And then think about how we tell the story. I think that's another important piece of this, is that the potential for UNESCO listing would position these in a way that, because we'd want people to come and see them. And yes, some of them are, they're obviously all visible from public rights of way, but, and some are accessible in different ways, but there it would unlock an effort, I think, to actually, you know, construct or build or occupy in one of these buildings some larger museum or interpretive center that actually tells the story and shares it with back with the world. And so as a kind of means of further telling and unpacking the significance of these sites, I think that's really something that could make waves in terms of moving toward that goal.
Well, and what I do love about Buffalo is it takes several people in a room.
It does.
And then they start the discussion. They raise, maybe you throw up a Facebook page to get some momentum going. And luckily we have a new mayor who's going to be completely interested
absolutely.
In this. So,
absolutely.
I couldn't be more excited. May this conversation give birth to something really formidable and concrete, da-dun-dun, and tangible. So in keeping with the theme of this podcast, and we've already addressed innumerable who knew factoids, lay one on me. What's a factoid that people know very little about?
Okay, I have two that I think might fill the bill.
Okay.
One is that Concrete Central has been a major site for paintball tournaments for several years now.
Okay, then.
Mm-hmm. And like serious paintball tournaments.
And Concrete Central, am I not mistaken? Isn't that the first... oldest. What's the importance of Concrete Central?
It's a quarter mile long.
Oh my God!
It was
okay.
Yes,
the largest. It's the largest. It was the largest in the world at the time of its construction, and it is the largest in Buffalo. That's that remains
in use as a paintball stadium. Okay.
Yes, really serious. I mean, serious stuff.
Okay.
And then
is this something that people come in from all over the mm-hmm, world? Mm-hmm. Okay, amazing, mm-hmm. amazing.
But it's all underground.
Okay.
Then the other thing that I think is pretty interesting is that the slip form construction process made the erection of the concrete silos, it was very fast. So, for example, the American was poured in 30 to 45 days, the main silos.
Mm.
And then...
I mean, this is a building the size of a cathedral, again.
Literally. Yes, it is. Literally. 30, because it was continuously slip form construction. And then, after, you know, then you have to put in the machinery and all of the pieces. So that building was set up in less than a year.
Wow.
But the silos themselves and that slip form happens very, very fast. And I don't think anybody realizes how quickly that happens.
Isn't that incredible?
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was that done expressly to make it operational quickly? Is that why they designed it that way, or?
I think that's just the nature of the process itself. Okay. And the process. So concrete was the best form. A circle was the best plan because it's equal distribution of forces.
And grain doesn't get stuck in corners.
Yes, and so that and getting it up quickly. Means that you have this slip form construction that goes up, and then that's how much time it takes.
And that offset the cost of construction considerably, too, because concrete is more expensive to build in than the wood, you know, mm-hmm. Previous constructed buildings. And so if you have a small construction window, of course, that drives down the cost overall. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do you have a factoid?
I do. So it kind of builds off of the
last. Who knew, Greg?
Yes, who knew? Related to the preservation of these buildings, because I think, you know, I mentioned how, you know, slowly we lose these one by one. You know, in 1990 and 1991, the Historic American Engineering Record did this amazing project to extensively document our extant grain elevators. And at that time, they produced this hundreds of pages long report that that documented thoroughly 20 of our extant grain elevator complexes. And that, so 1991 was when that was published. And since then, we have now lost 7 of those 20.
Oh, God.
And so that means we've lost 35%, more mm-hmm. than a third of the grain elevators documented by that Hare report, mm-hmm. Which also cites this collection as the most important collection in the United States, if not the world. And so the question is, at what point in this demolition of one by one, are we no longer able to claim that? Mm-hmm. You know, we've lost too much of our collection to continue to claim that this is such an important, piece of history.
We've got to have a critical mass.
Yeah. Yes.
In order to do what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's pretty startling.
It's a bitter factoid.
Yeah, it's not...
it's not a feel-good.
No, it's not a feel-good factoid.
So let's mobilize. Yes. Let's make this happen.
Yes.
I commit to you that we...
Maybe this is the beginning.
May this be the beginning.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I can't thank you both enough. I suspect this will not be a one-and-done with you. I think we'll have more conversations going forward, but I really appreciate you coming by.
Yeah, super
thank
fun.
Thank you. It was fun.